Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, where we strive to put children before adults. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Welcome to Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust. I'm so glad that you were able to join us again this week. This is the hour where we take a look at all things marriage and family from the perspective of the child. I've got Josh Wood here, my executive director, who's going to go through some trending news with us. But we're going to kick things off with a little bit of Bible time. I finished up the book of Matthew, was fantastic. And my husband suggested getting into Exodus. And I love that sort of New Testament, Old Testament, like back and forth. You get sort of both perspectives, both sides of the cross, and both of them bring so much richness and fullness. So I was reading through chapter 1 and chapter 2 of Exodus, just kind of getting back to the birth of this nation. And what you see is obviously a situation where the Hebrews are being dealt with incredibly cruelly. They grew very quickly. They had a lot of population power that the Pharaoh was concerned was going to turn into military power. And then he dealt incredibly cruelly with the Hebrew people, specifically the Hebrew children. And that very much is the case when the culture comes for us. Obviously, adults can feel the heat, but it is always children who ultimately pay the price. And the way the Pharaoh said for the children that they needed to pay was they needed to die. First of all, by sending, you know, Hebrew midwives in to sort of close the deal on killing the Hebrew children. And when they refused, he sent soldiers in to find the kids and throw them in the river. So that's where we find Moses's parents in chapter 2. I mean, as parents, like, so this is why I'm like, this is relatable, maybe not as extreme, but relatable, where I think all of us as parents, even when we were parenting in a more sane time where we would have said, oh my gosh, the culture is coming for our kids. Oh my gosh, there's a threat to my kids. And sometimes you don't exactly know how to get out of this situation. You don't know how to protect your kids. And I just found that in, you know, 25 years of ministry with my husband being a pastor, very often I would counsel women, specifically parents, specifically mothers who were trying to figure out, I don't know what to do with this schooling situation, or maybe they were in a situation with the child's father who had left them and come back into the picture, or whatever it was. I mean, really challenging issues. And sometimes we didn't even know how to recommend to God to fix the problem. We could not figure out, what does this even look like to honor God and come out of this on the right side with both me and my child or my relationship intact? Sometimes you just don't know what to do. And I think that that's probably what Yocheved was feeling here. Moses's mother is, I've kept this kid hidden as long as I can, right? He is now 3 months old. I have nursed him, but there is this mandate that I throw this kid in the river. Obviously, I can't do that. I love this baby. It's against God's will for me to do it, but there's no path forward for me to keep this child. And so I imagine that she's in the place that a lot of you have been in the past as parents, as Christians. And I will tell you what I have prayed myself and how I counsel other women and other parents to pray in those kinds of situations where you feel like there's no way out, there's no good possibility. I don't even know what to ask for from God. I say, pray for a creative solution. God, you give me a creative solution. You show me how I can fix this. You give me the path forward, even though to me, it looks like there's no path forward. So what's so interesting is Yocheved did exactly what Pharaoh told her to do. She put her baby in the river. I mean, she did it in a mini ark, covered with thatch, and the baby floated down under the watchful eye of his sister. I mean, talk about a creative solution. How that thing did not get like flipped over or snatched up by the waves or the alligators or whatever was in, I don't know. I mean, obviously God was working through that creative solution. But then it's so interesting because the basket, of course, happened to float into the one woman who probably had the power to actually protect the child, something that Yocheved could never, ever have planned, set up for. Even if she had tried to set it up, I don't think that it would have worked. The Hebrew mom going to the Egyptian princess and saying, take care of my baby. But God did work through this very specific maternal instinct that we talk about a lot at Them Before Us, which is that women tend to be more highly attuned to infant needs than men. It's not because men don't care about babies. It is because God has wired women differently. And one of the big differences, especially when children are newborns and infants, is women have a lower tolerance for babies crying. They cannot handle it. And so the Egyptian princess going down to the Nile to bathe hears this baby crying. And I know that some kind of alarm is set off in her brain, because that's set off in my brain when I hear a baby crying and somebody doesn't attend to the baby. I want to rush over and grab the baby. And that's what she does. She has somebody rush over, grab the baby, because there's something in her that says, I need to quell this child's distress. She opens it up. She sees the baby. She realizes that this is a Hebrew child. And then Miriam, his sister, goes back and gets her own mother to nurse her brother for another probably three years before she returns him to the palace to live in the absolute ironclad protection of the most powerful man in the nation. So that's what a creative solution looks like. If you find yourself in a situation where you don't know what to do, you don't even know what to pray, you can pray, God, give me a creative solution. I will follow you. I will honor you, but not at the expense of sacrificing my children. Show me what that looks like. So that is Bible time for today. Go ahead, Josh.
I can't not say that, you know, you look at Moses' mother, I don't think anyone would have blamed her for saying, they took my child. What do you want me to do? You know, that it wasn't like she was saying he needs to be murdered. What she did was put herself at great risk of being exposed and risked everything to possibly preserve his life. I think you have that because she recognizes the value of the child and is going to protect him at all costs. Well, you also have kind of the juxtaposition to a Pharaoh who also recognizes the value of the child. Why else would he be going after them? Because within our children is the potential of a nation. And so he knows, if I want to subjugate, I mean, it says that the Pharaoh forgot, right? They forgot what Joseph had done before. And now he wants them out. He's no longer grateful for their nation. He wants them gone. He wants them under his thumb. And so who does he go after? Does he try to come after the adults? You know, does he wipe out the laborers? No, he recognizes I will kill their potential, which lies in the young babies and children.
And it's an effective strategy for the most part. What we do see is many totalitarian regimes throughout, especially the last 100 years, that are bent on conquering and destruction. They target the kids. And so that is a bit of a segue into what we were going to talk about today as relates to kind of trending news. So Josh, tee up for us, you know, what's been going on at the DNC right this week?
Yeah, you're not wrong. It does segue. Unfortunately, we are beginning to see within even our own culture a degradation of the value we place on life. And we've gone from, in a very short time, people recognizing or trying to grapple with extreme cases of humanity, these cases around, I'm talking about abortion, these rape and incest, things that are truly tragic, which, again, we at Them Before Us believe that, you know, two evils aren't going to make it right. The child is a child, they are not the act that potentially created them. They are made in God's image. But we've gone in a very short time from grappling and trying to have honest conversations as a nation about these issues on the left and the right to what we are seeing now, which is a bypass of that conversation and really a celebration of, in some bold ways, which we'll see, a celebration of destruction and death, which I'm really not trying to be a sensationalist, Katie, but it does seem like we've gone past even, you know, these difficult conversations to we're going to normalize, we're going to sanitize and you know, anesthetize you to react negatively toward this, because that's part of our end goal. And so what we saw, obviously the DNC is up and running this week at the time we're recording this, and man, we are seeing a couple of signs of things that we've seen not only at the convention, but also now in their platform. So for the first 2 days of the Democratic National Convention, Planned Parenthood parked a mobile unit just a few blocks away that advertised free vasectomies, chemical abortions, and emergency contraception. So that would be the morning after pills to all attendees. As a bonus, they partnered with the Wiener's Circle hot dog truck to provide free hot dogs to people who visited the unit. That's not a typo. You know, obviously providing free abortions to attendees is gruesomely anti-child, Katie. But to be able to, I mean, there were pro-life activists who were even tweeting out the daily count. I mean, I hate even saying that, but the daily count. I think I read 11 the first day. Children lost their life at the intersection of that mobile unit in this convention, which is horrifying.
And the count at the end of the day yesterday was 25. And, you know, this sense that people get that there is one party that really seems to value family and value children's, and there is one party that seems to want to destroy families and children. It's not coming out of nowhere. I mean, they are parking a truck in front of their signature event to not only sterilize people so that they are not able to have children in the future, they want to end the life of the children that have already begun to live outside of their conference. So unfortunately, we're at the place where I don't think that the GOP has got this right in all different ways. But what we do have is we have the DNC. We've got a party that has made it very, very clear that they are anti-child in just about every way it is possible to be anti-child. So the other thing that we got to see, not just the kind of gruesome and not just anesthetizing people around it, but the celebration of it, right?
Yeah.
The ticker to show how many children's lives have been snuffed out since the beginning of the event. I mean, we have moved from a place where it was supposed to be safe, legal, and rare to a, oh, it's no big deal, to actually this deserves celebration, to, you know, we are now in this place where, unfortunately, there's nothing I can look at in the platform of the DNC that would lead to the protection of children, their life, family, mind, body, or future. A lot of the priorities that they push are in the name of helping kids, but they don't actually help kids. So, Josh, do you want to just hit quickly? Like, give me some of the planks in their, just list off, what are some of the planks in their policy platform?
Yeah, you see things like make Roe the law of the land again, which is, I want the government to take out of the hands of states and individuals the right to make their own abortion laws, and making it widespread, legal, and illegal to make it, to ban it as a state. Protection of a woman's right to access IVF, which again, really means unfettered access in whatever manner the IVF and fertility clinics want to do it. Removing the Hyde Amendment, or peeling it, so that because that prevents the use of federal taxpayer dollars to pay for abortions, which greenlights federal funds to pay for abortions. I mean, those are just a couple. Kind of give you an idea of, yes, we are normalizing this. We're not afraid to talk about it. It's a part of who we are. It's freedom in this area, scare quotes, at all costs. Do as you will.
Absolutely. So this is the victimization of children at the earliest stages of development, both in terms of their abortion platform, but also their reproductive technology platform, which, if you've been listening to this show, you know that IVF is not a child-friendly institution. Moving on through other parts of the platform, you know, they want to make it, they want to make sure that you can never stop a child from quote unquote transitioning, right? They want that gender affirming care, which really is just chemical and surgical mutilation of a child's body. They oppose things like school choice, right? They want to require that children attend public schools over the objection of their parents, even though those schools are very often sexualizing children and really taking them backwards in terms of their education. Many things in the platform are going to be confronted by Pro-Child Politics, the next book that Them Before Us is just publishing. And we are about to have on an author of one of those chapters, the author of the pornography chapter, who's going to talk about what can and should we do to protect children's innocence when it comes to digital technology. So stay tuned for that.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
I'm your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of Them Before Us, a global movement that seeks to defend the rights of children. I'm also the general editor of the next book, our new book, Pro-Child Politics, which looks at every political issue through the lens of, what about the kids? Put the kids first, and primarily, don't touch the kids. And so when we're talking about areas where we don't want you to get to the kids, one of the ones that is actually the most insidious when it comes to making its way into the lives of our children is rampant online pornography. And so we wanted to make sure that we addressed pornography in pro-child politics. And one of my criteria for who I invited in to be a part of this project is they need to be experts on the topic. They need to really have a deep understanding of the issue so that they can explain it to you in 3,000 words. But also, I wanted the people that were actually doing the work and showing us what it looked like to make positive change. So that's why I invited John Schweppe at the American Principles Project to write our chapter on pornography. So, John, give us a quick intro. Who are you and why is it that you and your organization are focused on fighting porn?
Well, Katie, thanks so much for having me and, of course, inviting me to contribute to the book. It was a real privilege and it was really cool to be able to do it. So I am the policy director at American Principles Project, and we bill ourselves as the NRA for families. So, you know, there's groups like the NRA that you know, fight the bad guys over the gun issue. You have groups like Club for Growth that fight for free markets, but there really hasn't been a cavalry for, you know, the pro-family movement, really going after the bad guys and helping the good guys. And so that's what we've been trying to build. And notably, you know, this year we're looking to spend somewhere between $18 and $20 million on this election cycle trying to help pro-family candidates win. So it's really exciting. And, you know, what I get to do, which is kind of fun, you know, we have all this political spending. I get to help realize actual policy successes as part of that. So, you know, we have the campaigns and the campaigns are important. You know, you want to see candidates talking about these issues, but you also want to see them govern in a pro-family way. And so we've worked with states and at the federal level on all sorts of issues, with pornography being one of them, trying to protect kids online.
Awesome. Yeah. And you guys have made some really good gains, which you highlight at the end of your chapter. But like all the other contributors, I forced you into the straitjacket of following this specific rubric for how you were going to lay out your area of expertise. And it was, first of all, to start with the story of a real life child who was harmed because we got porn wrong. Then to identify the lies about pornography and how those lies harm kids. And then to outline the truth. What is the truth about porn and how we need to think about it and legislate around it? And then what would it look like if we were to actually implement those truths in a policy space? So I want to just help people identify the lies that maybe they have also kind of fallen prey to. So the first lie that you outline in your chapter is lie number one, parents should be able to handle this problem all by themselves. Why is that a lie?
Yeah, it's a lie that even the Supreme Court perpetuated, you know, about 25 years ago, you know, this idea that you're a bad parent if your kids access pornography, which is totally crazy. You know, we recognize now, if you go back to the 90s, the reality was that, you know, there was maybe one, two devices max in a home, right? There was the personal computer, often in the living room. And so it was a lot harder for kids to access pornography then. Now, you know, I thought about this the other day, you know, it's easy for like a 14, 15 year old to have a device you're not even aware of, right? You know, you can go out there and buy these mini iPad type devices for only a couple hundred dollars that can access Wi-Fi, can connect to the internet. And so this idea that parents are supposed to do all of this on their own, that there's no role for government here in protecting kids from the most awful, terrible material there is crazy. And so I think it's really important, you know, what we've been trying to work on is getting both Republicans and Democrats to move past this antiquated idea that the internet can't be touched and, you know, into the idea that, you know, there is a role. We can help parents safeguard their kids and we should do it.
Okay, good. That's a great start. Let's roll into lie number two, which is pornography is free speech. So why do people say that pornography is free speech? That's not what I think of. But, you know, in the world of kind of policy work, that's kind of how it's been categorized. So why do people say that, well, this is just a free speech issue?
Yeah, I think in part it's ignorance, and in part, you know, it's a unwillingness to want to touch the issue. And so they use free speech as an excuse. You know, they point to previous Supreme Court decisions and say, well, the Supreme Court has said pornography is free speech. They actually haven't said that. It's not accurate. We still have obscenity laws in this country. But I think, you know, I said it comes from ignorance. I think in a lot of cases you have people who just don't really understand what pornography is today. So when they're thinking of pornography, they're thinking of, you know, Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue where you have nude models, you know, posing. That's not really pornography as far as we know it today. You know, that is that you could make the argument that's indecent. But what we're talking about today is the most violent, sadomasochistic, just disgusting material available online. And it really is just one or two clicks away where even a 10, 11 year old could access it. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we have to be safeguarding our kids from, you know, is they shouldn't be exposed to this kind of premature sexualization early, because as we're starting to see with all these studies, you know, it leads to a really warped view of sexuality that messes them up and really hurts them long term.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. And they have been able to fight a fair amount of legislation arguing that this is a free speech issue. But what you're saying is we can't look at it that way. This is a child destruction issue, right?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, so in these two cases that everyone quotes, and I won't bore your listeners with the legal details, but it's Reno v. ACLU and then Ashcroft v. ACLU. And the general takeaway is that there is a compelling state interest for the government to protect kids online, but they have to do it in the least restrictive means. And so the argument back in the 90s was, well, age verification, the technology isn't least restrictive. It would impose an undue burden on adults, so we can't do it. But it wasn't quite, this is free speech and there's nothing you can do. And so the laws that are passing in the states today and the way people are talking about this issue, there's going to be another Supreme Court case that's coming up very soon. You know, we believe that even under those precedents, we're going to be told, yes, you can absolutely do this. This is the right way to go about it. And, you know, we need to keep making strides in that direction. I think that, you know, once we are successful with age verification, maybe we should be looking at other methods to try to do this. Because, again, you know, pornography is obscene. And in this country, you know, our understanding of the First Amendment dating back to the founding has never been that obscene material that you can just do that. That's not what they meant. And so only recently have we started to basically say there's nothing we can do about obscenity. But Katie, I'll just point out as well, you know, that's not even true, right? We do have obscenity laws when it comes to in person, mm-hmm. right? You can't go walk around naked outside. You can't have, you know, intercourse in a public park. Right. So there are these rules. But when it comes to the internet, we just pretend there's nothing we can do and we want to just hide our heads in the sand. And we've seen the damage it's done. And so at this point, we can't continue to do that.
Yeah. I once heard somebody say, you know, a 10-year-old boy these days can see more naked women in 10 minutes than a grown man throughout history can see in his lifetime. I mean, like it is a problem on the scale of magnitude that's very, very hard to comprehend. And like you said, this isn't your grandfather's porn. I mean, we're not just talking about, you know, even just a XXX video that you would get like at the back of a store. I mean, we are talking about things that cannot be mentioned on radio, incredibly degenerate, violent. About 85% of pornographic websites contain some level of violence, often violence against women. And obviously there's all kinds of underage porn that has been, you know, trafficked, literally trafficked kids that are now being filmed and, you know, trafficked through in the name of pornography. And so it really is a major, major problem, especially when it comes to children, their formation, but also their protection. So then you go on and you talk about the truths about pornography. And the first truth that you said, you're like, here's the truth about porn. Number one, we should regulate porn. So tell me, why should we regulate it? How do we regulate it?
Well, I think it starts with we should regulate it because we should protect kids from this type of material. And I think understanding what that material is, understanding what the harms are that it causes to kids, you know, I mean, we're even talking about cartoon pornography, which, you know, simulates all the stuff. Now we have AI generated pornography. So there's all sorts of awful stuff. And there is, as I said, you know, and as the Supreme Court has said, a compelling state interest in doing this. That's not hard to get everyone on the same page. Actually, when you look at polling, you know, 83% of Americans support some sort of age verification system to protect kids from this material. So we're there on that. So then the next question is, what's the best route to do it? And this is where age verification technology has improved dramatically. And, you know, a lot of people are really worried about privacy. The reality is that, you know, your device has so many data points associated with it that you may not even be considering. You know, all these companies that get your data, they know that you went to Chick-fil-A for lunch this morning, you know, today. They know that you go to church every Sunday. They know everything about you. And so, you know, what this does is there's multiple different methods of age verification, from, you know, the classic inserting your ID, or, you know, biometrics, analyzing the data on your phone, all sorts of different things. And it's not intrusive, right? So adults will be able to continue to access this stuff, which I'm not saying that's a good thing, but they will be able to access it without much of a problem. The point here is, let's protect kids from this. And then, you know, we can have a policy debate over, you know, whether it's a good idea 18 plus, which, you know, I'll point out, we had a poll the other day. They were trying to attack Project 2025 over at Heritage. And they asked, you know, Americans how you felt about banning porn as a Project 2025 proposal. And it was 44-44. It was a total split. So we're actually working from a pretty strong position of popular opinion.
Okay, so your first truth is we should regulate porn. Your second truth is we can. I mean, a lot of people think, oh, well, even if we should, is it even possible? And I actually just had a conversation with Aaron Baer, our mutual friend over at the Center for Christian Virtue in Ohio. And he talked about how the only thing good that came out of this sports gaming bill that they passed there, because they had been trying to push it in Ohio, they finally did. But they said, we can't do this because we have to keep kids away from the gaming world, the gambling world. And they're like, oh, well, we can do age verification for that. And they're like, oh, can you? Oh, I see. When it's something that you want, magically you found a way to do age verification. Well, since you can do it in the gaming world, then you can do it for porn. So then you lay out the case that it actually is possible to implement regulations around porn. So what would that look like?
So these age verification laws that have passed, there's now 19 of them that protect kids from online porn. They actually allow for the porn websites to figure out how they want to do it. They can contract with third-party providers that are able to do all sorts of things. Katie, I just read a study about this the other day. They're now, you know, we've talked about biometrics, so they can like look at your face, determine what your age is, and then immediately delete that data because the bills actually require that from a privacy perspective. Now they've actually come up with biometrics where they don't even have to put your face on there. So apparently how you move your hand when you're waving it, they can tell your age based on that. Just incredible technology that's emerged over the last 30 years since the Supreme Court ruled on this. So, you know, ultimately, we have to be able to react to emerging technologies as legislators and be able to figure out, okay, how can we best protect kids? And we need courts to get out of the way and let the people in their legislatures act. So ultimately, you know, there is a big Supreme Court case coming up. They could take it away from us, I suppose, the right to regulate this stuff. But I don't think they're going to do that. I think this particular Supreme Court recognizes a lot of these decisions should be handled democratically, and that's where we should be going with porn as well.
Good. I'm Katie Faust. I'm talking with John Schweppe of the American Principles Project about the chapter on pornography that he wrote for our new book, Pro Child Politics. And at the end of the book, at the end of every chapter, I required each contributor to say, okay, show me where this has worked. So you've laid out the lies. You've talked about how the lies harm kids. You've told me the truth about your topic. You've told me how kids would be helped if we implemented and acted on those truths. But then I said, show me where it's worked. I don't want this to just live in ideology land. Who has done this right? And you at the APP have actually seen success when it comes to protecting children from porn. So tell me about that. Where have we seen some of these policies successfully implemented to limit children's exposure to porn?
Well, major credit goes to Representative Lori Schlegel from Louisiana. She was the first person to write age verification legislation and get it passed in her state. And so a lot of the states looked to what she did and the research she did and the experts she consulted with, and then they kind of copied it and got it done in their own states. So we're up to 19 states. Now, states have a limited efficacy. I mean, there's a lot they can do, but ultimately the internet is a little bit of a federal issue. So the way we've been, you know, kind of strategizing this, let's get as much done in the states as we can, you know, figure out where that leads us. In some of these states, major porn websites like Pornhub have left rather than comply with these laws, which I think is, you know, objectively a success. But now we got to look at the federal level and see, okay, can we do age verification at the federal level? Can we make sure that kids are protected in states like Illinois or California that haven't implemented this? And then also, and I think this is a really important one, you know, can we take care of the foreign porn websites that maybe we don't have jurisdiction over? Can we protect kids from that type of content? Oftentimes, that's the most illegal content out there. We're talking about underage pornography, all sorts of things. So is there a way to do that? And I think that's going to take federal legislation as well, which we're looking at American Principles Project right now and hoping to see introduced sometime next year.
Good. So in summary here, if you could have what you want in 10 years, what do things look like in the United States as related to porn and porn regulation?
Well, truthfully, you know, I think if we get to the point where you're not 18, you don't see pornography online, I think that's an enormous win, you know, because ultimately a lot of these addictions, and I wrote about this, we had a story from a man named Connor at the beginning of my chapter where he talked about how he got involved in this stuff so early. And we know the average age of first exposure to porn is 11 years old, right? So, you know, if we can get to it early, you know, a lot of 18-year-olds, if they've never seen porn, aren't going to suddenly develop the desire to go do that at that point, right? And so I think it's really important if we want to curb this stuff to nip it in the bud early. It's the same reason why we don't let kids smoke, we don't let kids gamble when their brains are still forming, because, you know, we don't want them to develop this addictive and really antisocial habit. So I think that's what we're trying to do here. I think we're going to be successful, Katie. I know a lot of these issues sometimes we get a little bit depressed about the state of things, but on this particular issue on protecting kids online, there is bipartisan agreement. There's a growing movement here. And so I think we might actually be successful in the next 2 years.
I love it. Well, the book is Pro-Child Politics. The chapter on pornography is written by John Schweppe of the American Principles Project, the people that are doing like pioneering work to protect kids online. We're really grateful for your contribution. Thanks for being with us, John.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
If you'd like to comment on the show, email comments@thembeforeus.com. Once again, here's Katie Faust.
We're back with Them Before Us Radio. I am your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of Them Before Us, a global nonprofit that seeks to defend the rights of children in matters of marriage and family. I am joined for this final segment by Jen Friesen, who is the training director for Them Before Us, and she has collected and is going to tee up for us some audience questions, because that's really what I want to be doing. I don't want to just monologue at you or give you my hot takes. I want to hear from you. I wish I could sit down and have coffee with you. We're doing the next best thing, which is getting your questions off social media and answering them here. So Jen, welcome back. Great to have you. And what are we doing first here?
Hi, Katie. Awesome to be back with you. Yeah, we have a few interesting questions today. And both of the big political parties in the United States have just had their conventions. Well, we're in the middle of the Democratic one right now. One social media follower, Christy, asked, how should we handle the discouragement we might be feeling looking at the Republican National Convention's platform? Because they made some big shifts when it came to marriage and the pro-life movement. So how should we handle that?
Well, you're right to be bothered by it. I'm glad you're still thinking about this weeks after it took place. We did talk a little bit about it on the radio program when it all dropped and came down the pipe. And you're right to be bothered. Right to be bothered by how it happened, because they completely bypassed all of these very federalist, very grassroots systems of creating a platform. And you're also right to be disturbed that they gutted a lot of the things that we consider to be primary issues. That's not to say that political issues, you know, that all of them don't have some level of importance. But when you're talking about life, family, and religious liberty matters, those are on an order of magnitude in terms of the implications for all other policy conversations, but mainly just like culture at large, that those things we can never water down. They can never change. We can never compromise on them. And because we did, especially in those two areas, you are right to be concerned and alarmed at that. Ryan Anderson at the Ethics and Public Policy Center talked about, you know, how are we supposed to, especially as pro-lifers, how are we supposed to respond to this transformation of the GOP into something that is much less distinguishable from the DNC? And his recommendation, which I totally agree with, is Pro-lifers, those of us that believe that children have a right to life and a right to their mother and father, and that is why we support traditional marriage, because it's good for kids, it's good for everybody, but primarily, like, kids need it to thrive. As he said, we have to stop being a cheap date for the GOP. Like, we actually do need to put a little bit of fear in them that you can't just do whatever you want and we're going to go along with it and punch our ticket for the GOP candidate. They really do need to risk something if they move away from especially these three issues that really need to top the hierarchy of what it is that we value when we go into the voting booth: life, family, and religious liberty. So I think the answer is you continue to let that pebble in your shoe bother you all the way for the next 4 years. You keep it at the forefront of your mind, and we have to double down on education. That, you know, side note, that is one reason why we are so excited that Pro-Child Politics, our next book, is out before the election, because it's an incredible tool to help people understand that these issues are not things that are going to just come and go, that we can just redefine, remake them depending on the political winds of the day. No, there are some unchanging, inalienable realities of children, and we need to prioritize them and fight for them, regardless of what the laws say, and even regardless of what our own party might say about it. Jen, do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I was just thinking, you know, ultimately we have to compare two sides, two sets of policy too. It's not just these characters at the very top of the national politics that usually get most of our airtime and most of our consideration. But even when you look down the line all the way to from federal to state, I do think it's pretty obvious which side leans more pro-child. But if we just start looking, what's the most pro-child option I have? It, to me, those decisions feel a lot clearer. But it's okay to be frustrated. And we should be calling, emailing, getting people together. As we learned from, like, Megan Basham's new book, the evangelical voting bloc is a really significant part of the more political right. So we do have a lot of power, but we need to wield it properly to get them to do what we want them to do. Be consistent. Okay, next question. This one's from John. What should you do if your 12-year-old comes to you and says that she is non-binary? And maybe describe to you what that means to maybe people who are like, well, I don't even know. I'd have to Google it first. I don't know what that means.
Well, what does non-binary mean? It's sort of this this no man's land where there's no fixed identity when it comes to male or female. The child is not saying, I am trans, like I am the opposite sex. They're not saying, I am the sex that I am was born to be, either a little boy or a little girl. Non-binary just means I'm coloring outside the lines. And so it actually is a very convenient label for children to give themselves if they want to opt out of the oppressor group. So especially if your child is a boy, especially if they are white, unfortunately, a lot of the messages that the culture is sending is you are bad. You, by your very nature of your sex or your skin color, are an oppressive force. You are somebody that, by your nature, has been responsible for subjugating minorities or women or oppressing them. And so adopting a non-binary label for themselves is actually a very convenient way to escape that oppressor class and join into and enter into the oppressed class. And in this ridiculous woke sort of Marxist rubric through which we are viewing pretty much everything, where everybody is a part of either the oppressed or the oppressor. And it's not based on your moral decisions or your character. It is based on these immutable characteristics of skin color or sex, maybe your religion. But it's generally things that don't have to do with, I made a good choice or a bad choice. And so a lot of these kids, especially young kids, some that are, you know, white or heterosexual or even Christian, they're automatically being lumped into this basket of people that should be derided. So the first thing that I would say is, if your child comes to you and says, I am non-binary, there is a temptation for parents to react, whether it is reacting because you're going, no, you're not, or a reaction going, oh my gosh, who said this to you? Or a reaction of going, not in my house, you're not. I would just urge you to pause. And instead of flipping out, we have something in our second book, Raising Conservative Kids in a Woke City, where Stacy and I outlined this principle. It's called the no flinch rule. Don't flip out. Don't flinch. Keep your game face on, very, very calm, and just start asking lots of questions. Why do you think that? What does it mean? How did you hear that term? Why do you think that you are like that? Why do you think of yourself as non-binary? What do you think is going to happen as a result? Like, what kind of good things do you think are going to come? What kind of bad things are going to come? Really, really bring the temperature down. And then I would say, I would highly suspect that the reason why your child has decided on this label is because other kids in their friend group are also identifying with this label. Oftentimes, these sort of LGBTQ identities are not because they have some kind of deep abiding gender confusion, but because they function as a social contagion. They see other kids that are adopting these identities. They see some kind of benefit, whether it's a community inclusion, whether it's an escape from the oppressor class, whether it's simply finally being one of the cool kids. There's some kind of benefit to adopting these identities. So figure out what it is and then start to carefully sever them from those influences, whether it's a friend group, whether it is some kind of curriculum being taught in their sixth grade health class. But very, very likely what's happening is they have a smartphone and they are constantly on Reddit or TikTok, and the algorithm is feeding them influencers and subject matters and platforms that are telling them that this is who they are. So what you need to do is keep the temperature low, discover the sources of this information, draw them near by asking questions, and then very, very carefully start to put your finger on who's influencing your child and separate them from those influences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so good. I mean, I shared on our Them Before Us podcast in like episode 2, my story and some of those things that had impacted me growing up. I didn't grow up in this era, thank God, but I felt some of that confusion about what does it mean to be a girl. And some of that's just because I had more interests that were stereotypically masculine, not really similar to my female peers. And then you have these difficulties with your parents' marriage and things like that. So I totally agree that asking questions really, really would have helped, because it gives you space to articulate some of the things you're thinking and feeling, and the space for an adult to give truth back to you, truth and affirmation. What does it mean to be a woman? It's okay if you like wearing this kind of clothing or you like doing these kinds of activities. That actually doesn't change anything about who you are on the inside. And yeah, I think like you're saying, when you don't freak out and you just now use that as this is a key that my child needs a lot of reaffirmation in their maleness or femaleness, and it's okay to like those different, video games or colors. Or I had a friend whose son came to her when he was a preteen and thought he might be gay. And she just said, "Oh, why do you think that?" And it was because he liked horses. And it was so easy for her to say, "No, that's not what makes you gay. And let's go look at a Western movie and look at all these people who take care of horses or do all these things," right? And you show them that your gender identity, who you are as a man or woman, is not tied to, "I like these different things" or "dress this certain way," you know?
Good. Yeah, I love that. And what your friends did about the kid who thought he was gay because he liked horses. The right answer, because you're first going to separate the child from the negative influences, but then you have to reinforce the truth in your kid. And the overall message of what they're hearing from sort of the LGBT identity community is your body is an obstacle to your true self. Right? Whatever is going on with your body, that's a hindrance of who you really are. The real answer from the Christian perspective and just the overall like physical and mental health perspective is your body is your true self. Your maleness or your femaleness is good and God-given. And you don't have to like pink if you are a girl to be a real girl, right? You can be a sword fighter. You know, you can be a fencer. You can be a professional diver or a top chef or whatever it is. Like, you don't have to necessarily fall into these stereotypical pathways. The validation that you need is your body. You can always look to your body. Your body's going to tell you the truth.
Yeah, that's good. All right. Final question. This one's from Sasha. "I'm in a marriage where we've been together almost 20 years. It's not horrible, but it's not great. I feel like my life is just stuck. Our kids are in middle school. Is it okay to leave to go be really happy?"
Hmm. Interesting that you write us at that moment of your marriage. My husband and I have been married for 26 years. We have a very good marriage. He is a good man. We've always been very committed to one another. We went through a very, very rocky time in like year 18, 19. And so first of all, marriages go through rocky times. Second, there are times, you know, obviously the reason the vow exists is we say for better or worse. And a lot of the time the for better comes after the for worse, or the for better comes and goes and the worse, you know, comes and goes. And so The power is in the vow. The power is in the staying. And obviously, it would be incredible if you guys could develop a genuine friendship, mutual respect, activities that you both love to do together so that you can rekindle that relationship with one another. And if you're wondering how to do that, what you want to do is do something that you both enjoy together. I remember during those really challenging marital years, Ryan and I had, I felt like one thing in common that we could do without fighting or being angry or being tense. And it was just play cards, play rummy, play cribbage or whatever. And I'm so grateful that we had that shared experience. So ideally, that's what you want. You want to become genuine friends. You also are going to do that by revealing emotional information to one another. Like whoever you're revealing emotional information to, you will create an emotional bond. So that's what you can do. But even if you don't, you stick it out. You stick it out. Even if your marriage never becomes the marriage where, you know, you're talking about how you're best friends and you can't wait to spend time with each other on the weekend, there is something in the sociological world called the good enough marriage. It's the marriage where maybe, you know, you're not spending every night together and going on walks or having these deep romantic, you know, conversations, but it's good enough. You're committed to one another. You're stable. You respect one another enough. You're cooperating and collaborating, you know, on raising the kids. That's actually good enough. And it's enough for your kids to then launch and thrive into the real world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes me think that no, your kids are not going to be happier when you're, quote, happier, if that means you leave and get a divorce. And for the most part, it seems like kids have no clue when they're adults, the adults and their mom and dad are happy or not happy, in the sense of we're going off of stability. Are my parents together at dinner every night, even though they don't feel this heightened romance and this deep connection with each other, but they're with us? That's what kids are thinking about. And so I just totally agree with everything you're saying of it's so good to go and be making an effort to make sure your marriage is getting healthier. You feel more connected, all those things. But then at the end of the day, it seems like kids aren't gauging their lives based on how you feel about each other, gauging it on safety and how they feel, you know, in their home.
Yeah. And we talk a lot at Them Before Us, you know, in our first book, Them Before Us, Why We Need a Global Children's Rights Movement. We talk about the three staples of a child's social emotional diet, the three things that kids need if they are going to launch into the world as healthy, fully functioning adults. I mean, obviously they need things like food and exercise, but they have social emotional needs too. And those three staples, the things you cannot cut out, are mother's love, father's love, and stability. And they need them all day, every day, all their life. And a divorce is going to cut mother's love in half and father's love in half, and probably stability will be gone completely. So divorce from the adult's perspective might look like some kind of escape. Divorce from the child's perspective is the beginning of a nonstop, unstable, often revolving door of relationships in either the mom or the dad's life, and the loss of the only home they know where they got all three every day. Well, it was great to have you. We'll see you next week.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.